research.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here to act as guide along these highways and byways of science is Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, whose lectures on these same adventures in research have taken him throughout the country.
Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone.
Well, what are we going to talk about today, Dr. Thomas?
I have several subjects to discuss, Mr. Shannon, all of them interrelated and woven together into a story we'll call Eyes and Ears for the Millions.
Eyes and Ears for the Millions. That's a colorful title, all right, but what's it mean? And what are some of these subjects?
Oh, the telegraph, telephone, radio, television, all of them as timely as tomorrow. As absorbing a story as any thriller ever written.
I'll agree to that, Dr. Thomas. Radio alone is still an amazing miracle to me after all the years I've been in it.
It is to a great many people, and the story of how radio and radio broadcasting came into being is an equally amazing one.
It shouldn't be much of a secret to you, Dr. Thomas. After all, your own particular field of science is electricity.
Yes, but just the same. New ideas and new applications of radio waves are constantly flowing from the laboratories and industrial plants. And it's important that we keep abreast of these improvements, you know.
Oh, sure. It's easy to fall behind and suddenly find yourself out of date.
Exactly. Since the dawn of civilization, man has ever tried to improve the art of communication. And history is filled with reports of inventions and discoveries along these lines.
You mean like the Indian smoke blanket signals and the tom-toms of the jungle tribes?
That's right, yes. And all the improvements that followed. And since radio is based on electricity, any discussion of it could go back many years, say to the discovery of the peculiar spark-producing properties of amber when this material was rubbed on a piece of cloth or fur, or to the magnetic attraction in lodestone, dating such knowledge as far back as 600 B.C.
That's a long way to go back, all right.
However, just now we're interested in the story of radio and how modern broadcasting grew from the simple experiments of amateurs, conducted both before and after World War I, to become the mammoth industry it is today.
That's a mighty big story, Dr. Thomas.
Yes, it is, and a fascinating and exciting one. The fact that modern radio has developed into a miraculous art which wields such a tremendous influence on our everyday lives is in itself a monument to all those unsung, uncrowned men whose tireless efforts and hard work made that development possible.
Not to mention those valiant souls who stayed up night after night, missing meals and sleep, to hear a varied assortment of wails, squeaks, and grunts over their earphones.
I remember that myself very well. Just the same, radio owes a great deal to those early listeners in to the wireless. Without them, radio wouldn't be what it is today.
Well, just for the record, Dr. Thomas, when did radio broadcasting actually begin?
That, Mr. Shannon, is what the legal profession would call a leading question. Radio broadcasting as we know it today began with the first regularly scheduled broadcast, the Harding Cox presidential election returns, on the night of November 2nd, 1920.
1920? Why, I thought it started long before that.
Many other people think the same thing, but nevertheless, that's when radio broadcasting was born. As a matter of fact, the term radio broadcasting wasn't even coined prior to that date. True, there had been many earlier wireless transmissions. Reginald A. Fessenden and Lee DeForest sent out experimental programs as far back as 1906 and 7. In 1919, Dr. Frank Conrad, one of my engineering associates, began some experimental programs from his station in the garage of his home. The November 2nd broadcast was the culmination of these programs and other experiments and research efforts, both before and after those dates.
I see. Then the November 2nd broadcast put radio, as we know it today, on a regularly scheduled program basis. Is that right?
That is correct. And KDKA has continued to broadcast on a regular schedule every day since that date.
That must have been an exciting night for all concerned, for the men who did the broadcasting and the listeners who heard it.
Yes, radio history was made that night. The dawn of a new era of communication. And few, if any, of the men who took part in that event could possibly have realized what a tremendous force was about to be loosed on humanity.
I'd like to have been there, or even had the privilege of hearing that broadcast. It must have been a real thrill.
It was, for all concerned.
Where did that first scheduled broadcast originate, Dr. Thomas? And what was it like? You were right in the middle of things around that time, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Not on the broadcasting end, of course. I was interested more in the technical side of wireless. However, suppose I set the scene for you and try to recreate the program as closely as I can from the records and from memory.
All right.
The broadcast itself emanated from a very small room atop a factory building called the K Building in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Just a crude little shack it was. The room, I mean, not the building.
Yes.
Inside this small room, bare except for the transmitter set in one corner. And incidentally, this transmitter weighed only about 500 pounds. Contrast that with KDK's present transmitting equipment, which weighs around 328,000 pounds. Next to it, running lengthwise, a long table, three chairs and a high stool. And around here was gathered a group of men. An announcer, an engineer, and a checker. And two men taking down election returns as they came in over the telephones.
Oh, you mentioned a checker. What was his job?
His job was to check the messages for clarity and correctness before they went on the air.
I see. For those early days, that sounds like a well-thought-out arrangement, Dr. Thomas. The returns came in by phone, the checker checked them, and the announcer gave them on the air. Well, come to think of it, election returns are given pretty much the same way today.
Don't look so surprised, Mr. Shannon. A great many radio patterns or formats had their beginnings in those early days of radio. That arrangement worked on November 2nd, 1920, and it still works.
What time did the election returns broadcast go on the air that Tuesday night, Dr. Thomas?
Oh, it was about 6 o'clock, and a stormy night it was, too, raining cats and dogs. But the election interest and excitement made the weather a poor second as a topic of conversation.
I can imagine.
Newspapers ran banner headlines reading,
"Greatest vote in nation's history in spite of storms. Heavy vote being cast.
Harding awaits complacently result of vote.
Governor Cox more confident than ever, he says."
Meanwhile, Dr. Conrad was standing by at his experimental station, 8XK, ready to take over in case of transmitter trouble. And up in the small room, our group of radio broadcasting pioneers completed the last-minute details for their broadcast. Finally, the time came.
Okay. You fellas all set?
We're set, Jim.
When I throw this switch, you start talking.
Right.
I'll give you the signal. Okay. Everybody ready?
Right, sir.
Yeah, I'm up there.
Okay, it's all yours.
This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We shall now broadcast the election returns. We are receiving these returns through the cooperation and by special arrangements with the Pittsburgh Post and Sun. The election returns will be broadcast as soon as they are received by us here at KDKA. We'd appreciate it if anyone hearing this broadcast would communicate with us, as we are very anxious to know how far the broadcast is reaching and how it is being received. Write your card or letter to station KDKA, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And now, while we're waiting for the returns to come in over the telephone, direct from the Post and Sun, I'll give you the list of offices in today's presidential election. Here they are. Some 30 million Americans are electing a president of the United States, a vice president, 34 United States senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives, governors of 34 states, and thousands of minor offices, county judges, and officials. Okay, those are the offices to be filled. And here are the 7 complete presidential tickets that are being voted on. I guess you all know these names pretty well by this time, but there's no harm repeating them. And we have to wait for the returns anyhow. Here's the list. Republican, Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Democratic, James M. Cox and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Socialist, Eugene V. Debs and Seymour Stedman. Prohibition, Aaron S. Watkins and Lay Colvin. Farmer Labor, Parley S. Christensen and Max S. Hayes. Socialist Labor Party, William Cox and August Gilhaus. Single tax, R.C. McCauley and R.C. Barnum. Well, those are the candidates running for the various offices in this election. And we're going to stay right here and broadcast the returns as they come into us. So please stand by.
And so the election returns continued, intermittently, throughout that night.
And here's another one here, a return from Topeka, Kansas. The first 206 votes counted in four scattering precincts have Harding, 109, Cox, 96, and Debs, 1. That's Harding, 109, Cox, 96, Debs, 1.
Okay, I'll take over while you get some coffee and sandwich if you want. Anything happen?
No, nothing much yet. It's too early. So what time is it?
A little after 11.
We've got a long way to go yet. Oh, look, I just gave this photo from here. I'm just going to give this one from Norwell, Massachusetts.
All right, I'll look. Thanks.
Reports from the town of Norwell, Massachusetts, giving the complete vote on the presidential electors and the gubernatorial candidates are: for president, Harding and Coolidge, 409. Cox and Roosevelt, 48. And here's an item about President Wilson. After receiving the early election returns, President Wilson retired to his bedroom at 9 p.m. tonight and was asleep a half hour later. Oh, just a minute. A bulletin has just come in. I'll read it to you. The Democratic candidate, James M. Cox, and his chief manager, Chairman White, of the Democratic National Committee, have conceded the election of Senator Harding. Yes, sir, the election is conceded by Cox to Harding. And it looks like Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge are the men who will carry the affairs of our nation for the next 4 years. Of course, don't forget all the returns are not in by any manner of means. So stand by and we'll give them to you as they come in. So you'll have the complete story as we broadcast.
Gosh, that must have been quite a broadcast, Dr. Thomas. Was that the end of it when Governor Cox conceded?
No, by no means. The schedule called for the election returns to be broadcast from the time the polls opened to about noon the next day. Around noon on Wednesday, November 3rd, a very tired, sleepy group of broadcasters gave the final returns. That is, as final as they could be up to that time.
Swept into the presidency with the largest popular majority in history. The greatest popular vote in the history of American politics. And the largest electoral vote ever rolled up by a Republican candidate. Harding's electoral vote had reached 391, with indications that doubtful states might carry the figure to the 400 mark. And so, here are the incomplete returns again. Harding, 391 electoral votes. Cox, 127. Now, before we leave you, I'd like to ask all those who heard this election broadcast to communicate with us, telling us how it was received. We are anxious to know how far the broadcast reached. Just write a card or letter to Station KDKA, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, signing off until 7 o'clock this evening.
And that was it.
That was it. The first regularly scheduled broadcast in radio history. And to the men who broadcast those election returns and to the few hundred listeners, it was more than just that. It was the dawn of a new age of communication.
It seems to me there's a great deal more to this story of radio, Dr. Thomas.
Indeed there is, Mr. Shannon, a great deal more.
Well, then suppose we make it a date for next week.
That's agreeable. See you then.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another in the series of programs titled Adventures in Research. Your guide telling the story of the first scheduled radio broadcast in history was Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is Paul Shannon inviting you to join us again next week when Dr. Thomas will be back to tell more about Eyes and Ears for the Millions on Adventures in Research.